You're listening to a Truly Criminal podcast exclusive. This episode contains themes that some listeners may find distressing. Listener discretion is advised. This week's Truly Criminal podcast exclusive takes us to Portland, Oregon, to a case that has mystified authorities and true crime enthusiasts for well over 60 years. The baffling disappearance of the Martin family. A tangle of damning coincidences and unanswerable questions. The year was 1958. The Everly Brothers and Elvis Presley were rocking the charts. Dwight D. Eisenhower was in the White House. America was struggling through a tough recession. And across the water in Cuba, a young charismatic revolutionary named Fidel Castro was leading a revolt against the corrupt Batista regime. In Portland, Oregon, the close-knit Martin family, 54-year-old electrician Kenneth, his 48-year-old wife Barbara, and their three adolescent daughters, Barbie, Virginia, and Susan, were busily preparing for their favourite time of year, Christmas. For the Martins, Christmas wasn't just a time for family, it was also a time for the whole community to get together and celebrate. Kenneth, or Ken to his family and friends, a gregarious and good-humoured man, made it his duty to dress up as Santa Claus each and every Christmas. Neighbours remember him fondly standing out on the frosty porch of the Martins' Tudor-style home, dressed in his bright red Santa costume, and handing out homemade candies to all of the children who lived on 56th Avenue, which was lovingly called Candy Lane during the holiday season. Children flocked to the Martin home every December, and Ken became somewhat of a neighbourhood celebrity. Needless to say, the Martin family were extremely popular and well-liked in their Roseway, Northeast Portland neighbourhood. When they weren't spreading Yuletide cheer, they were organising local talent competitions in the springtime, lemonade stands in the summer, and bake sales to raise funds for good causes. Ken and Barbara's three daughters, Barbie, 14, Virginia, 13, and Susan, 9, were equally popular in their schools. Active members of academic and sports clubs, as well as being hard-working students, the girls were loved by teachers and fellow students alike. Ken and Barbara also had a 28-year-old son, Donald, who was serving with the Navy in New York at the time. Donald's relationship with his parents was strained, and he was reportedly the black sheep of the family. Everyone in Portland who was asked about the Martins stated they seemed like the perfect family and were ideal neighbours. So, when the family of five mysteriously disappeared without a trace on Sunday the 7th of December 1958, whilst out for a walk in the countryside, their whole community was shocked, bewildered, and deeply saddened. On the evening of Saturday, December 6th, the day before the mysterious disappearance, Ken and Barbara were attending a Christmas party at a neighbour's house. Ken wore his trademark Santa Claus costume, and the couple were said to be in high spirits the entire night, laughing and joking with each other, as well as others in attendance at the traditional neighbourhood get-together. The next morning, while the Martins were eating a hearty breakfast and listening to Christmas songs on the radio, the doorbell rang. Ken got up to answer it. It was the Evans family, relatives of the Martins, stopping by briefly to ask if the Martins would like to accompany them to a mutual friend, Kevin Welch's house, for a roast dinner that evening. Ken informed them that he was sorry, but they couldn't. The family already had plans for that day. They were heading out to Columbia River Gorge to hike in the wilderness and pick greenery and furs for the children to make Yuletide wreaths out of. The conversation ended amicably with promises to eat together soon at a future date, and Ken waved them off. The Evans later stated that there was nothing untoward about the conversation, and Ken had seemed his usual merry and jovial self. However, they did state that Ken seemed to be a little reluctant to go into further details for their plans for the next day, and quickly changed the subject. Neighbours claimed they witnessed the Martins' car leaving their Roseway home in the early hours of that chilly afternoon. Ken was said to be wearing a tan zip-up jacket and dark slacks, and his wife was reportedly wearing a blue coat and black dress. Frank Womack, who was washing his car across the street, reported he watched the Martins leave at around 1:30 p.m., However, another neighbour, Ella Chin, who lived down the street, told investigators she thought she saw the family of five driving away closer to 2 p.m. Although there were slight discrepancies in their reported departure times, both neighbours stated the family had seemed in high spirits as they all piled into their 1954 cream and maroon Ford County Squire station wagon. Although precise details of their whereabouts after leaving the neighbourhood proved hard to pin down, it's believed they drove eastwards towards Columbia River Gorge, as they were next seen 40 miles away in the small riverside town of Cascade Locks at around 4 p.m. when Ken pulled the family's station wagon into a local gas station and bought 4 gallons of gas. The owner of the gas station said the family continued east on Interstate 84 towards the gorge after filling their car up. The family were next encountered for the last time before they vanished at a roadside diner in Hood River called the Paradise Snack Bar, shortly after leaving the gas station in Cascade Locks. Paradise Snack Bar waitress Clara York would later tell authorities that she had served the family cheeseburgers and fries at around 4:30 p.m. and they had all seemed happy and content, if a little hungry. Clara said she was pretty sure of the time she served them, as it was just beginning to get darker outside, and she had turned on the parking lot's floodlights immediately after bringing out the Martins' food. Clara also stated that a couple of ex-convicts who were known in the area were eating in the diner at the same time as the Martins and left immediately after the family of five. The owner of the diner also corroborated Clara's account because he was an acquaintance of both men and said they came into the diner often. The two ex-convicts, Roy Light, also known as Richard Allen Hunt, who lived close by in a shack, and Lester Kenneth Price were arrested the following day on December 8th for stealing a white 1951 Chevrolet and dumping it near Cascade Locks. Unfortunately, the relevance of this arrest to the Martin family's disappearance wouldn't be recognised until weeks later, when the investigation was in full swing. The last known eyewitness accounts of the Martins place them around the north bank of the Columbus River, close to the Bridge of the Gods in Cascade Locks at around sunset. The Knutsons, a local couple, said they thought they spotted the Martins sat in their Ford station wagon while seemingly talking to two men who were standing next to the car in the same area. However, they added they couldn't be certain due to the failing light of late dusk. Sadly, these final fleeting glimpses of the family at sunset would be the last time they were ever seen alive again, and would also be the start of an enigmatic mystery that would span nearly 60 years and outlive its most dogged investigators. The following Tuesday morning, as light frost glazed the ground, Taylor Eccles, the owner of Eccles Electric Home Service Company, was growing increasingly concerned. His best employee, Ken Martin, hadn't shown up for work. He hadn't come into work the previous day either. It wasn't like Ken at all. He hadn't called in sick, and every time Taylor attempted to call the Martin residence, no one answered the telephone. Ken and Barbara's three daughters had also been noted missing from their classes at Grant High School and Rose City School. Teachers were troubled by the lack of contact from the usually diligent students and their hands-on parents. The teachers, like Taylor Eccles, attempted to contact the family by telephoning, but all calls went unanswered. Strangely, neighbours later reported that on the morning of that day, a taxi was seen parked outside the Martins' house for over an hour before leaving. The reason for the taxi's presence has never been explained, and is another truly puzzling facet of the case. By the evening of that same day, still not having heard anything from Ken, and now overcome with worry, Ken's boss, Taylor, finally reported the family missing to the Multnomah County Police Department.
What's the address of the emergency?
Officers were dispatched to the Martin home at around 11 p.m. that night and walked into scenes eerily reminiscent of something like the Marie Celeste. The house appeared to be completely undisturbed. There were no signs of forced entry or of any violence. The Christmas tree stood proudly in the corner of the living room, decorated beautifully with carefully wrapped presents stacked underneath. Plates that the Martins had eaten from on the day of their disappearance were still piled on the drying board, waiting to be put away. Laundry still soaked in the washing machine, and, saddest of all, Ken's Santa outfit was still carefully laid out on the sofa from the last time he had taken it off. The responding officers were equally spooked and baffled. Realising they had a very serious case on their hands and under pressure from the family and friends of the Martins, the Multnomah County Police Department escalated their search efforts straight away. And within days, the neighbouring Hood River County Police joined in the investigation to inject manpower and resources. Huge search parties were organised and volunteers combed the countrysides around Columbia River Gorge. But not a single trace of the Martins was found. Multnomah County Detective Walter E. Graven was made lead investigator of the case, and the search for the answers to the family's fate would become a lifelong obsession for the relentless veteran detective that would last until his dying day. Graven was an investigator that could have been an inspiration for any number of detective mystery novels. Tall, lean and broad-shouldered, he doggedly chased down leads whilst wearing his trademark fedora, horn-rimmed spectacles and tan trench coat. He was a detective that could have walked straight out of the famous and popular television cop show Dragnet. Many of Detective Graven's colleagues believed that the Martins had accidentally driven into the river and drowned and were pressuring him to close the case. However, from day one of the investigation, Graven believed they were dealing with a case of multiple murders. He wrote in a thick brown notebook he carried around with him everywhere, "Why the Martin case is murder. The Martins refused to go to Kevin Welch's with the Evans for dinner. Why? Ken Martin said we had better do as planned. When asked by Evans what plan, Ken Martin stated just for a ride. Yet they did not leave for 2 hours after the Evans left. It was getting dark at 4:30 p.m. at that time, yet they left at 2 p.m. to go to the other side of Hood River. This indicates that they had a date to meet someone, as Martin did not like to drive after dark, yet knew it would be dark in 2.5 hours. It also indicates they did not want anyone to know about the trip. Therefore, they had received a phone call or letter from someone who would give them information about Donald or some other excuse about something they did not want known." Days passed. Christmas came and went. The Martins' home, once full of laughter and joy, remained eerily silent, and the gifts neatly piled up under the Christmas tree remained unopened. On the 28th of December, when a woman's glove resembling one that may have belonged to the Martins' eldest daughter, 14-year-old Barbie, was discovered in Cascade Locks, in the immediate proximity of the stolen Chevrolet, detectives interrogated the two ex-convicts who had stolen and dumped the vehicle the day of the Martins' disappearance. However, the questioning of Roy Light and Lester Kenneth Price led nowhere substantial, and investigators soon gave the promising lead-up in favour of other possibilities. As the weeks slid into months, the police departments were inundated with hundreds of telephone calls and letters from people who said they had seen the family. The Martins had allegedly been spotted all over the United States, and even a psychic medium called to inform the police that she had had a dream where the family were deep in water by a pole. As with most big police investigations that garner widespread media attention, many of these tips proved to be cases of mistaken identity, completely misleading, or even outright fabrications. However, there were a few potentially strong leads amongst the letters and telephone calls detectives deemed worthy enough of further investigation, such as the owner of an orchard, who reported to authorities he'd seen a man and a woman collecting branches on an ancient Native American burial ground close to his orchard on the evening of the 7th of December. He went on to claim he'd witnessed flocks of buzzards circling a nearby canyon the following day. Unfortunately, the extensive searches within the canyon and the surrounding areas proved fruitless. Strangely, around this tragic and deeply troubling time, Ken and Barbara's eldest son, Donald, refused to come back from New York to aid in the search for his family, despite being granted leave from the Navy. This was something that raised a lot of eyebrows in the Martins' neighbourhood, as well as in the Multnomah County Police Department. Detective Graven in particular began to take a keen interest in the apparent black sheep of the family, 28-year-old Donald, especially after he was informed by friends of Ken and Barbara that Donald and his parents had a very contentious relationship due to a past incident. Graven spoke to every witness he could and made copious notes on the case. He discovered that Donald, who repeatedly referred to his mother and father as the fat slobs, had been fired from his job at a Meyer and Frank department store a few years before for shoplifting items from the sporting goods section. Graven jotted in his notebook that the relationship between Donald and his parents had turned sour when he was caught taking merchandise. The thefts were over $2,000. He admitted to the thefts. However, there were also further unsubstantiated rumours swirling around the Roseway neighbourhood that Donald had been discovered having a relationship with a local man. Kenneth and Barbara had reportedly been infuriated by this and had first sent Donald to a Christian boarding school and then shipped him off to the Navy in the East as a kind of punishment, due to their religious views and also the prejudices that were rampant at the time. Whatever the reason for the estrangement, Detective Graven began to strongly suspect Donald of being involved in the disappearance somehow. If it wasn't Donald, it may have been someone that Donald knew, someone like the mysterious Wayne, a college roommate of Donald's and family friend of the Martins. Wayne, who was engaged to marry a nurse at the time, was also said to associate occasionally with persons of interest, Light and Price. It was also claimed that it had been Wayne who had told Ken and Barbara about their son's sexual orientation. He is mentioned repeatedly in Graven's notes, but was never fully interviewed by the police or Detective Graven. The reason for this has never been fully explained, although it's believed that Wayne could have been protected by his father, who was apparently a very prominent figure in Portland at the time. Graven theorised the motive for the murders of the family of five possibly involved one of the Martins' daughters. The detective later told confidants he believed if Donald wasn't the mastermind behind the murders, then it may have been a close friend of Donald's. Graven speculated that an associate of Donald's, who was about to be married, may have gotten the oldest daughter of the Martins pregnant, and this was the motive for the homicides, to keep the infuriated couple quiet. Graven further noted in his brown notepad, "With Donald Martin eliminated, girl's most likely motive, so had to be a friend of Donald's, whom Ken Martin had found out about and was going to expose, therefore had to be a married man, or one going to be married." It was a tangled web of theories and possible motives, and Detective Graven's suspicions were further reinforced with the discovery of startling new clues and a series of disturbing coincidences. In February of 1959, 2 months after the family vanished, amateur detective Donald D. Bain was searching the countryside around the Dallas, a town to the east of Portland and close to where the Martins were last seen. It was here he made a shocking discovery. On a cliff edge above the surging waters of the Columbia River, he found tire tracks leading over the edge. Bain also discovered cream-coloured paint chips scattered and flaking on the surrounding rocks. Detective Graven was one of the first to rush to the scene and noted, "There were no return marks to show that this particular vehicle returned and apparently was either pushed or driven off this cliff." Investigators conclusively matched the tyre tracks to the Martins Ford County Squire station wagon, and after extensive testing by the FBI, the paint chips were also matched to the same make and model as the vehicle. Detectives now had their first big breakthrough in the case. Coincidentally, person of interest in ex-convict Roy Light lived in close proximity to where the tracks had been discovered. But without any concrete evidence, detectives felt as though they couldn't question the car thieves any further in relation to the case. To make matters even stranger, another piece of compelling evidence was discovered near to where the glove and the Chevrolet had been found. A man, only named in reports as Mr. Cox, was out for a hike in the area and discovered a pearl-handled 38 caliber pistol hidden underneath some bushes in the dirt. The handgun was badly damaged and caked in dried blood. It also had a single spent round in the chamber. Cox handed the pistol into local sheriffs for processing straight away. Detective Graven was still on the case and chasing down every single lead. He used the gun's serial number to trace its origins to a department store, the same Meyer and Frank department store that Donald Martin had been fired from years before. And, in a shocking twist that seems as though it's ripped straight from the pages of a Hollywood script, Graven learned that the pearl-handled gun was one of the items that Donald had been accused of stealing. Donald was only spared arrest because detectives didn't have enough supporting evidence. There were as yet no bodies, and Donald had an airtight alibi in New York City. Bewilderingly, the sheriff soon returned the handgun to the man who found it, without having it processed as evidence. The sheriffs told Cox that the handgun wasn't related to any ongoing investigations and wasn't important. Cox's wife, Bonnie, told reporters in the mid-80s.
And then it was completely coated with the dried blood from whatever they had clubbed. They had clubbed something to death, apparently.
Once the handgun had been returned to Cox, he had cleaned it and fixed it, and kept it as a morbid souvenir until his death. It was as these promising leads and incriminating coincidences were coming to light, 3 months after the disappearance of his parents, Donald finally made the trip back home to Portland, although he wasn't coming back to aid in the investigation. He was returning home to settle his family's estate and life insurance policies, which were valued at around $36,000, and would be kept in a mandatory probate until he could legally inherit it all. While he was back in his hometown, Detective Graven jumped at the chance to question Donald. The pair sat down together and talked over a coffee. Interestingly, the sole surviving member of the Martin family told the detective, "I know of no one who would murder my folks or no reason for it, but I don't see how it could have been an accident." After meeting with the detective and returning to New York, Donald also wrote Graven a brief but curious letter. The letter read as follows. "This past weekend I have thought over all you stated, and I only pray to Mary that you are somehow mistaken, although I can see little hope otherwise. I know of nothing more to say. Thank you for everything, and I will remember you in my prayers." It is not known what statement Donald is referring to in the letter, as Graven didn't keep any records of the casual meeting. However, the detective did jot down in his notebook around the same time, "Had to be planned by, redacted, no one else with motive." The name of the suspect has been scribbled out. Modern technology has since proved the word underneath the heavy black scribble was in fact one single name, Donald. Although why Detective Graven scribbled it out remains another mystery. Authorities, now believing they were dealing with a homicide, desperately needed to find the bodies. They sent divers into the river to search for the Martins' vehicle in the areas closest to where the tire tracks had been discovered. Although Graven had been told by locals that the location was a good place to dive, and anyone who knows how to dive would have no trouble in this area, visibility in the murky waters proved to be extremely poor, and the undercurrent stronger than anyone had expected. When an experienced diver almost died, the water-based searches were called off. Instead, investigators decided to try a different tack. They enlisted the help of the Army Corps of Engineers to lower the waters behind the nearby Bonneville Dam. With the water levels lowered, they hoped it would make spotting any sunken vehicles much easier. Unfortunately, this idea failed as well, and detectives were left where they had started, staring down into a deep and dark water that refused to give up its secrets. That was until the 1st of May, 1959. The crew of a river drilling barge moored in close proximity to where the authorities had been desperately searching near the cliffs, decided to pull up their anchor and move to a different drilling area. Except they couldn't. Their anchor had become lodged on something that the crew later described as heavy and metal. The crew, knowing of the search for the Martins' car in the same waters, tried desperately to bring whatever it was to the surface, but unfortunately it dislodged itself and sank back down into the depths. However, a few of the crew had managed to spot what looked like bundles of clothing drifting in the deep, and were also able to make out the silhouette of a car before it disappeared into the murky darkness. Early the following morning, Ellery Colby and his wife were fishing for salmon and trout on the banks of the Columbia River, nearby to Cascade Locks. The married couple fished in the area often and knew the area well. However, on this day, they hadn't caught anything of note, They were just about to start packing their equipment away to go home when Ellery pointed out something strange floating down the river to his wife. They thought it looked like a body and were horrified to see it was soon followed by another, smaller body. The couple noted down the position and quickly made their way back to town to inform the authorities. Within the following 2 days, the authorities discovered the badly decomposing bodies of the two youngest Martins near to the Bonneville Dam. 13-year-old Virginia and 9-year-old Susan had finally been found. The children were conclusively identified by dental records, and although a mortuary technician who fingerprinted and photographed the bodies strongly stated he had witnessed bullet holes in both of their skulls, the cause of death was recorded as drowning by the acting medical examiner, Dr. Waterman, the coroner in charge. Interestingly, traces of smelted aluminum from the aluminum plant in Cascade Locks were also recorded on the clothes of both girls, bringing forth the possibility that the victims had been in the vicinity of the plant or had come into contact with someone who had. The area where the vehicle is believed to have driven off the cliff is close to the plant, as was the shack owned by ex-con Roy Light. When Detective Graven took it upon himself to drive out to the plant and visit Light, who kept resurfacing in the investigation, coincidence after coincidence, he found it empty. Roy Light and Lester Kenneth Price had gone, whereabouts unknown. Authorities spent the following days and weeks painstakingly searching the river for the rest of the Martin family. Divers were again utilised, as were helicopters and sophisticated sonar equipment. Sadly, these efforts too turned up nothing, and when another diver almost drowned and the weather took a turn for the worse, the search was once again called off. The river wasn't ready to give up all of its secrets, and Ken, Barbara and Barbie remained missing. Their fate's a mystery. Detective Graven continued to chase down leads, but as the months turned into years and the case grew colder, it became increasingly frustrating for the investigator. Colleagues had started to put a lot of pressure on Graven to close the investigation down, with Sheriff Francis Lambert allegedly burning Graven's reports and telling him, "We both know it's time to stop pursuing the case." Despite all of this, Graven refused to give up on the Martins. He wrote in his notes at the time, "Even though I can get no cooperation from anyone, there is no murder that cannot be solved." A few weeks later, on the 23rd of May, the county held a funeral for the two youngest Martins. Their bodies were cremated in a service attended by family, friends, and Detective Graven. One person who didn't attend was Donald. He would later claim that he mixed up the dates, but the ashes of his sisters remained languishing in storage for the next 10 years until they were taken by an unknown person. Not only did he not attend their funeral, he didn't even collect their remains from the government. 7 years later, he did, however, collect his parents' inheritance from probate and use the funds to move to Hawaii. He found a job teaching at a high school, got married, had 4 children of his own, and never once spoke of his parents or sisters. He died in 2008 at the age of 73. His children, now adults, refused to speak to the press about the 1958 Martin family disappearance, stating it's a chapter in their family history they would all rather forget. Graven, finally defeated by the mystery, retired from the police force in 1966. One of the last things the detective wrote in his notebook was, "Will be solved if I live long enough for the car and the bodies to be found."
Month marks 60 years since a Portland family just disappeared. And I know, Jeff, you have been covering this story for a long time.
I guess you could say it's almost an obsession with me. The evidence needed to solve this mystery may be rusting on the bottom of the Columbia River.
My grandfather was obsessed with this case.
Greg Graven grew up surrounded by the Martin case. His grandfather, Walter Graven, was a Multnomah County detective. His family saved his grandfather's case notes, and they clearly show Detective Graven was convinced of one thing.
He believes that it was a homicide and that it would be solved when that vehicle is located.
22 years later, in 1988, with no further developments in the mystery, Walter E. Graven passed away, still haunted by the case he couldn't solve. his daughter told the media decades later. Dad assumed that probably Kenneth Martin was shot in the head, and the girls and the mom were then probably knocked out, and the car shoved into the river. It's really deep where this particular spot is. As of the writing of this podcast, the disappearance of the Martins is still an ongoing case. Chief of the Dallas Police Department, Jay Waterbury, told reporters, "It's an open case of the disappearance of a family of five." Experts supporting the police department added, "The gun seems to be at the centre of all of it. It sort of ties all of these other little events together. As far as the possibility of it being a homicide, there are just so many coincidences that point that way." What happened to this Portland family may always remain a deeply tangled and confusing mystery. Hopefully, someday, the vehicle and the remaining bodies will be found, so that the Martins, along with the many questions still haunting this case, may finally be laid to rest.